You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse and WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings.
Allentown is struggling again. This proud city has faced countless challenges over the years. Some of its problems, one could argue, are of its own making. Taking too long to realize that doubling or tripling the density of the old neighborhoods by allowing investors to turn single-family homes into multi-unit properties would diminish the quality of life certainly hurt. Not being more aggressive about enforcing code compliance or nuisance ordinances didn't help. Not merging with Parkland School District when it had the opportunity to do that 50 years ago was, in my judgment, a disastrous mistake. But there are many ways that Allentown has been a victim of circumstances. Who imagined that Mack would stop building trucks there, or that Nations Bank would buy Chrysler First and shut it down, or that Hess's would shut down? A sordid cocktail of social, economic, and political incidents have challenged the city in countless ways. Today, the kids are shooting each other on the street. It's a 21st century OK Corral run amok. People want action, but few are very confident they know the antidote. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. And I'm your host, Alan Jennings. I have the proud honor of being able to do this show once a month. And I like working with Neil Heaver, who is doing the production work in the studio and keeps me from making too much of a fool of myself. Amazingly, though, to get back to the subject at hand, the guy who finds himself in a position to lead the way is a former gang member and felon working for a relatively new nonprofit called Promise Neighborhoods. That man is Hassan Botts. Welcome, my friend.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
In a recent op-ed, I'm not going to read it to our listeners, but in a recent op-ed, you wrote with poignancy about Allentown's misery and talked about it from your perspective as having been a former gang member and felon. And it does put you in a really unique position. Tell us about your life and how you got to the position you're in now. I mean, go through that story.
Well, again, thank you for having me, Alan. I'm excited to be here, and I can talk a little bit about my journey and all of the people that have contributed and experiences that have contributed to me being here. So just to briefly share, I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and I came up from Brooklyn, the Brooklyn of the 80s. So this
is I was going to say, not the Brooklyn of gentrification.
No little Yorkies and French Bulldogs 3 o'clock in the morning walking down Franklin Avenue. No, this is the Brooklyn of the 80s, the rap hood that Jay-Z talks about.
You know? Got it.
So this was we laugh now, but this was a dangerous place. This was a place that shares, you use the language of, was struggling, right? This is a place that was struggling, that was had the highest crime rate at the time, that had dilapidated schools, that had a lot of structural issues that exist. So being that, I would say I became a product of my environment. I come from a family, a very loving family. I had a mother that loved and adored me, so this is not a story of someone that did not have resources, that did not have access. This is a story of someone that had a series of poor choices and associations from being in an environment that was riddled again with crime and violence at staggering and levels. So grew up in Brooklyn. I moved to the Poconos when I was about 16 years old to stay with my mom. She wanted her children to live, you know, and that was the situation. She wanted us to live, so we moved out there. Spent a couple years in the Poconos. I moved to Allentown my first time in 1994, I believe it was. I was about 19 years old, moved to Allentown. So the interesting thing about my relationship with Allentown is I've lived in Allentown 3 times as an adult. I've moved back here. So I've realized that this is home, that I love this place, that this is the only place that I've chosen to live multiple times and that I'm staying. I was arrested my last time. Well, to back up my life, I was arrested my first time at 11 years old for what was considered a stolen car, and arrested my last time in Allentown in 2008. And when I returned from prison, was sentenced to 5 to 10 years in prison. When I returned, my mother, who's been very influential in my life, shared a statement with me because I was going to move to Philadelphia, Atlanta, a larger market where there were a lot of opportunities available for me. So I don't self-identify as a felon, more so as a prison survivor and as someone who's formerly incarcerated. I was going to move to Atlanta. I was going to move to Charlotte. I was going to move to Philadelphia. I had a lot of opportunities there. And I do believe in restorative justice. I was raised upon restorative justice. And my mother said, Allentown is the community that you harmed, and it's the community that you need to help repair, that you have a duty to move back there and to stay there. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, so that's what motivates me every day. People say, well,
where's your mother now?
My mother passed in November of last year. Yeah, but she was very influential in my life. When people say, how did I end up around this table? I ended up around this table because I had a mother that didn't quit on me when I was younger. And then later in life, I met mentors and people that believed in me. I mean, even this conversation we're having now, there's something that you believe that I have something to contribute. And that's really what we talk about, you know, and how do we build community? It's people taking risks, people believing in one another, and people believing in this ability to change. So, I stand on the shoulders of some giants, of the ancestors, you know. And again, I had a mother that wouldn't quit on me. I was left back in kindergarten. I was left back in 7th grade. I spent 3 years in the 9th grade. I was pushed out of high school. Like, the route, the journey wasn't easy. Lots of mistakes, lots of poor choices, lots of poor associations, lots of decisions based on the context of my environment and the structural violence that existed, as well as the interpersonal violence that existed in that environment, the lack of resources. But I'm still here because people did not quit on me.
And you are Dr. Hassan Botts.
Correct. Despite, right, all of those experiences and failures, you know, today I sit here as Dr. Hassan Botts.
And you know what's really cool about that? First of all, you're about 20 times better educated than I am. All I've got is an undergraduate degree to show for my academic background. But, you know, most people, when they get a PhD, they make sure everybody knows it. You know, they want to be called Dr. So-and-so. You know, I don't think I even see you put your PhD on your letters. It doesn't, you know. Where did you get the PhD?
A school called Nova Southeastern in Florida.
Yeah, I'm familiar. Yeah. Fort Lauderdale?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. So,
where did you get the undergraduate?
Undergraduate is from North Carolina, Gardner Webb University, undergraduate in human services. And then I got a master's in social work from UNC Greensboro and A&T, North Carolina A&T, a joint master's program. Then I went back and back to school. And I don't self-identify based on necessarily my educational experiences. I believe education is a credentialing process. And I was told by some mentors of mine that in order to do the work that I needed to do, that I had to get that credential just so that people would listen to, you know, a kid from the hood, essentially.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, it's a pretty remarkable story of redemption. Why did you make the turn? I mean, you know, if I could figure out what it is that makes the difference between, you know, you could have twins who were raised in the identical environment. One takes off in the wrong direction, the other one takes off in the right direction. And, you know, figuring out what it is that makes that happen is something that, I mean, would be really the most important question we could answer, I think, in our society. What was it that, I mean, you gave credit to your mother, but you also, I mean, that she was your mother when you were making the wrong decision.
That's right.
So what was it that made Hassan Botts go in the right direction and so many others choose the wrong direction?
So I went in the wrong direction for a very long time. And I don't think it's like this linear, you know, there are times that I danced on the right and the wrong side, right? And when I give credit to my mother would always say to me, and again, with tears in her eyes, she would say, when you put half the energy you put into doing the right thing that you put into doing the wrong thing, you'll change the world. Mm. And I realized there was some truth to that, you know, that I could change my community by putting all of my passion into doing the right thing and removing myself from the wrong thing. And a lot of it has to do with companionship, and a lot of it has to do with forgiveness. I mean, you talk about this redemption story. My redemption story, you know, there's this Ubuntu principle that we stand by that says, I am because we are, therefore because we are, I am. And I don't stand here alone. Again, I stand on the shoulders of the ancestors, and also I stand with a community that was willing to embrace me and welcome me back after I've harmed it. So there's a restorative practice piece to my story that I think when we talk about the people that have not made it, the people that haven't had an opportunity to come back and contribute, oftentimes it's because they're unwelcome, because we're unwelcome and we're rejected. You know, when I came home from prison, I wanted to do volunteer work, and none of the agencies that love me would even let me in the building. You know, because I was formerly incarcerated. I still had a skill set. I still had skills to contribute. I still had an opportunity to make a difference. But the fact that I was formerly incarcerated, people continuously rejected me. And I had a support system that told me to keep pushing forward. A lot of people, they don't keep going because, you know, the door is not open. So, you know, we talk about redemption in this community and in this country. And what happens is it's more than just an individual responsibility. The community has a responsibility to welcome people and to create on-ramps for people to practice their genius and contribute to what's going on. What I found within Allentown and what I'm trying to foster and create through my story and my work is that Allentown is a place, or should be a place, where mistakes are forgiven and allowed to be made. And the fact that you've made mistakes doesn't exile you from the island. Doesn't mean that you can never, that, you know, that you're just thrown away for life, that, you know, you've paid your debt to society. Now we'll make space to you for you if you want to do the right thing, to come and contribute to our community.
One of the things that I find interesting about you is that you have what appears to be kind of like an inner peace. Is that an accurate observation? I mean, you know, I'm mad as hell about injustice. And I grew up in the white suburbs, you know, raised the way, you know, you're supposed to be raised, so supposedly. My father was an alcoholic. I mean, it's not like we had perfect life, but, I had all the advantages that and privileges that, you know, of a white guy with blue eyes and, you know, all that kind of thing. But I'm mad as hell about the injustices, and you've experienced injustice. Why is it that you come off as being so cool about your place?
I think what it is to a certain degree I have to, because people are terrified of an angry black male.
Yeah.
So you have the privilege to be angry. I was told it was
not as much of a threat, you're saying.
To
the status quo.
The perception to the status quo. That's right. I mean, people and again, I'm a small guy size-wise, but you know, it's interesting, even when people describe me, they describe me as much bigger than I am. Or even, you know, if I just raise my voice, you know, there was the Facebook post of me being frustrated and upset around injustice, and people said I was violent, and there was nothing violent about that, but that's the perception, you know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was busted twice before I was out of my juvenile years, and you know, I never went to jail. I had a probation officer. I had one meeting with a probation officer. Mm-hmm. It was marijuana possession, which never should have been a crime in the first place. But, you know, my friends, we stole the driver training car from high school. I mean, we were doing all the things that you probably did and got away with it,
That's right.
So anger is, it's one of the things that I find really interesting about you is that you've been through all this stuff and yet somehow you're able to contain any fury that I think is natural given what you've done and been through.
Well, I channeled it, right? So there's a passion that I have. There's a sense of urgency that I carry with me, that the work needs to get done, that the people need to heal, that the opportunities need to be presented. Like, I stand in equity. And I don't think that you can live in this country or live in this community and not be angry. Yeah. You know, like if you're not angry about children being in cages, then you really need to take a long look at yourself. But it's how do we express and how do we work together and how do we communicate, you know, that anger and that frustration.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. I have with me in the studio Hassan Botts, who is the guy who runs the Promise Neighborhoods. It's a new nonprofit, relatively new nonprofit in the area. And Hassan has either put himself on or has found himself on the hot seat, really in the middle of the storm that's taking place in downtown Allentown right now. We're going to talk about his efforts after the break in a couple of minutes. Did the criminal justice system mistreat you?
Yes. The criminal justice system is designed to mistreat people the way that it's set up. So that's from arrest to reentry to release. I mean, I talked about my first arrest being 11 years old, and you know, it was considered a stolen car. This was a car that someone had given to us, and for whatever reason, it turned out to be stolen. But it was a huge opportunity to embrace some youth and you know, we were incarcerated primarily because of the community that we're from. So that was one of the first injustices, so to speak. Then I can tell the story of the first time I was arrested, sent to an adult facility. I was 15 years old, and I was sent to an adult facility for stealing socks. And no one ever asked, why were we stealing socks? Or did I need the socks? Or did I have socks? And the interesting thing was, this was in New York. We were arrested at 15. And again, I stand 5'6 right now. So imagine me 5'2, 130 pounds possibly, you know, being put in an adult facility. And being the kids that we were, clowning like we were clowning, you know, we were disrespectful, to say the least, to the arresting officers. So when they took us to the facility, what they said to the corrections officers were, give these guys the treatment, you know, with my air quotes. And they took two children. So I lied about my age. I was 15. I said that I was 16 because my buddy was 16. He was small and he was scared. So they didn't want him to go there alone. So it's not that 15-year-olds are put in adult facilities. But in New York, everyone over 16 is considered an adult. So they took two who they believe were 16-year-olds, and they gave us the treatment, which was handcuffed us and put us in a cell with predators intentionally. You know, wow. So that night changed my life.
This is one of those scared straight kind of things, like they did in the penitentiary in Jersey.
No. This was the real deal. This was you were arrested. We're going to throw you in this cell, and we're going to walk away from the cell.
My God.
And you
got to
survive, handcuffed. And the only blessing that there was in this situation was that they handcuffed us from the front, not the back. So we had to survive throughout the night in those circumstances. So, I mean, and I share that not to say, like, this is isolated. Right before I came here, I was with a young man who's 22 years old, has been incarcerated since he was 16. He's been home 2 days. And he was telling me he spent the last 11 months in a hole, in isolation, in solitary confinement, in single cell isolation. So he came home from the hole, and just being, I knew that meeting him, you know, I know the look, I know, you know, I'm a trained therapist, and we talked, he was talking about a job and all of these things. And I said, no, we need to really focus on your mental health. I need you to transition back into the community first and foremost. Like, 11 months in a hole is a long time. 5 years in jail for a 16-year-old is a long time. You know, he was a Pine Grove. He couldn't shake my hand because of some scars, some scarring on his hand. And it's like, prison is a dangerous, a lonely, a depressing, and a scary place. And the thing that we have to keep in mind when we think about prison is that 95 to 97% of the people that are incarcerated are returning to our communities. So we have to provide some kind of healing and support. Prison is trauma. All trauma survivors need healing. And as a community, we want to create a space where people can return to our community, receive the healing that they need, and reintegrate back into society. So at this point, what we're doing as a country and as a community is we're incarcerating at record numbers people who are impoverished, people who are wrestling with issues of equity, people who are trauma survivors, and sending them to a dangerous place that's not working, and we're returning to communities that are not providing support. So,
yeah. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. This is WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. And I haven't said a thing that's funny like I usually do, because there is absolutely nothing funny about the situation going on in Allentown and the stories that Hassan Botts have. So I appreciate your sticking around. We're going to take a quick break, as we always do. Come back. There's plenty more to talk about with Hassan Botts from Promise Neighborhoods.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Thanks for sticking around. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest with me is Hassan Botts from Promise Neighborhoods of the Lehigh Valley. Hassan is a fascinating guy with an unbelievable story that breaks my heart to listen to. Let's talk about gangs. Are gang members scared? I mean, you know, what you hear about gangs is the violence and, you know, but the brotherhood, if you will. When you get into a gang, does it make you feel safer or more at risk? You were in a gang, right? Was that in Brooklyn or here?
In Brooklyn. So gangs are about a sense of belonging. Gangs are about a community. Gangs are about welcome. And when we don't have that in our communities, that's what it creates. If Farsh said, everyone, we're social beings, and everyone needs to be a part of something. Everyone needs to be connected and bonded to something. So you say, are they scared? The alternative is isolation, and we know isolation kills, right? This is the perception, is that they'll be alone out here in the world, or they'll join, they'll bond to something. You know, I'm thinking of, again, the young man that I was just sitting with. A young lady brought him into my office that was a gang member, and she was talking about, so he's a gang member, high-ranking gang member. He just came home 2 days ago from prison. She's in our office talking about how she got out of the gang and how she had to get jumped out of the gang. And she's talking about the lifelong scars and damage that she has from that 68 seconds, I think she said it was, that she was jumped by, you know, five or six people. And, some of the damage she has to her eyes, some other damage that she has going on that's lifelong. But she said it was the best decision she made. She wants to get out. He wants to get out, but he said they won't let him out. So we were able to negotiate with some of the high-ranking gang members a few weeks ago, where if someone wants to get out and they come to our office, that if they're part of that set, that we can get them out. So we were talking to him about some ways to get them out. So I think when you have, it's not scary when you're not alone. You know, again, so we have that Ubuntu principle that I was sharing with the young man earlier, and I said it's I am because we are, therefore because we are, I am. And really emphasizing to them that they're not alone, that they have a community that supports them, that they have a community that welcomes them, and that there are different choices that they can make, and that there are resources available. So he's thinking he has to go back to the streets and sell drugs. And I'm telling him, no, can you survive on $10 an hour for the next 90 days? And he said, yes. So I shared with him a program that Valley Youth House has in partnership with the Promise Neighborhoods, where he can get in, he can get some training, he can get a job opportunity that gives him some room to breathe and to reconnect and heal. You know, and this is a gang member. This is a high-ranking gang member. You know, even some of the young guys that get in, They want to belong. They want to be a part of something. You know, they don't have a basketball team that they. Or speaking for myself, I didn't play sports as a kid. I didn't have a basketball team that I belonged to. I was pushed out of school. I was never welcome in school. You know, I tell people the story of all the juvenile and adult facilities I've been in my life. The worst place that I've been is the New York City public school system. So school is not an experience of welcome and success and achievement. But in the streets is where I got my success, and the streets is where I won, where I found out what winning felt like and where I found out what success felt like. So you build on that. So we have to find spaces for our youth. We have to find places for our youth. We have to create relationships with our youth to so that they can connect. It's all about connectivity.
Is the machismo, the cold-heartedness that seems to be so pervasive among gang members, is that a real thing? Is that real, or is that a front? I mean, it seems like so much of what's going on there is violence, that you've got to find a way to make sure people understand, don't mess with me because I can hurt you. What's that dynamic, you know, the violence aspect of it?
Well, I would say that violence is pervasive in our society,
yeah,
and that it looks different in different spaces. I mean, so I go back to my school experience, and this happens every day to students from our community in school. Is, you know, teachers told me that I would never amount to anything, that I would die in a pool of my own blood, that I was worthless. I mean, that's a form of violence. that our kids have to experience. You know, over-policing of our communities is a form of violence. You know, not being welcome in Starbucks is a form of violence that our kids have to experience. So, you know, it's pervasive. This is all around us. Specifically in gang culture, yeah, it's a violent place. I mean, you know, we talk to the kids from gangs. We talk to the kids that are returning from juvenile facilities and let them know that there were things that they did to survive that they can get beyond, you know, and healing happens in community. Healing happens in relationships. Healing happens when people can be authentic and can be honest about the decisions they made out of fear. I used to work at a juvenile justice facility up in the Poconos. So all of the juvenile justice facilities in Pennsylvania use restorative practices. So you have to write these victim impact statements. And I was working with one young man that he couldn't leave because he wouldn't write the victim impact statement. So I'm really talking to him about, you know, how do we get you to acknowledge the harm that you've done? And he said, nobody gave a damn when I was assaulted. No one ever cared about me. Why should I care about them? I mean, I bring that up to mention that we have to start caring about people. We have to start practicing compassion. We have to start practicing understanding, even for the perpetrators of violence, because every perpetrator of violence, from my experience, has been a victim and is a survivor of violence. They learn it somewhere. You know, we live in a violent society, and collectively is how we're going to change that through compassion, not more violence, not more jail, not more prisons, but through compassion and accountability.
You've got some serious street cred, and you know the gangsters, but you also have to have credibility with the police. So how you know, you have to walk a really fine line to pull that off. The rules are different depending on your environment. Do you feel fear for your safety? I mean, are you at risk by the work you're doing?
Some would say that. I mean, I don't feel at risk. I have relationships with humans, you know. So there are officers like Captain Granitz who shows up the events, Glenn Granitz who we know. We have a relationship. We can talk. We can have honest conversations. We need assistance. He's there. If I need assistance, if he needs assistance, I'm there. This is relational work. The same thing with members with people that are in gangs. I mean, these are human beings, and we meet on a human level. And you know, so I think I have credibility because I develop trust with people. I do what I say I'm going to do. If I can help someone, I do, and if I can, I let them know. I try to be non-judgmental, but I hold people accountable on both sides. I think there are again, violence goes both ways. So we have to hold. Let people know that we have new norms that we're looking to establish in our community that are based on welcome, that are based on compassion, that are based on connectivity. You know, we really, my work is centered around increasing hope, increasing a sense of belonging, and increasing agency, meaning people can make purposeful decisions in their lives and in their communities. So I'm always trying to empower people. I'm always striving for liberation, whether that's in the boardroom, whether that's on the block, whether that's with practitioners, whether that's with teachers, you know, the superintendent, the mayor, the five-star general of a gang. I show up as the same guy.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. My guest is Hassan Botts, Dr. Hassan Botts, a former gang member and prison inmate with a PhD. How do you feel the APD is handling the situation in the neighborhoods right now with the gang shootings and everything? Is that a dangerous question to ask you, given, you know, the friendships and relationships you need to protect and everything?
Well, I don't believe that violence is solely the job of the police. So I think the community has a responsibility. I think that it's convenient to call for more policing when violence or crime increases, but I think that there's an opportunity to call for more community programming and community support and family development and family support services. You know, the police are designed to do what they do. There's a rapper, Freeway, from Philadelphia, and he has a line in a song where he says, "Don't you know the police sole purpose is to lock us down?" That's the primary role of the police department, is to investigate, arrest, and incarcerate folks. The criminal justice system in general, right? You have the powers of investigation, the powers of arrest, the powers of incarceration. and supervision, even community supervision. So that's a primary role. Now, what we would hope for is compassionate policing, right? We would hope for compassionate policing. We would hope for community policing. We would hope for relationships so that the police know who the bad guys are, and that they can manage people in the community accordingly. And, you know, we have some good ones and we have some bad ones. But the system in general, and this is not about APD, this is about the criminal justice system, is severely broken. It does not work. I mean, you have well over half of survivors of crime do not even report the crime. They don't trust the system. So whether we're talking about, you know, arrest, whether we're talking about even incarceration, like, people do not get what they want. Restorative practices is the answer. And what that means is sitting down with people and addressing the harm, is finding alternatives. When victims of crimes are giving alternatives, they do not choose to have people locked up for decades. They choose to increase safety in their community, and that's done through accountability. That's done through, you know, other alternatives.
Tell us about Promise Neighborhoods.
Promise Neighborhoods in the Lehigh Valley is centered around cradle to career success. So that means that every child in our neighborhood, essentially across the city of Allentown, will graduate high school ready for the next phase of their lives. And we know what that requires. That requires prenatal health care. That requires family support. That requires health care, mental health care. That requires a strong educational system and background. That requires all of the social determinants of health that are necessary. And the programming that we primarily have is we focus on leadership. We have a program called Leadership Without Limits that looks at the next generation of leadership. We believe that the leadership we have is not the leadership that we need. It does not reflect the needs of the people. So I believe in the direction that the world, so to speak, our world is going, is that people with lived experience should be leading the causes in their communities, that people have the capacity in their communities to heal, have the capacity in their communities to be successful. So people with lived experience should lead the causes. So we're developing leaders across the community to contribute to the conversation and to guide the direction that resources go. We also have a program called the Allentown Parenting Network that is modeled after the Detroit Parenting Network, which is very similar. It's empowering parents. Who cares most about the outcome and the success of children? Our parents. And that's not the narrative that's being told. So we do a lot of storytelling. We help people to contribute to their narrative rather than have other people telling it. And we empower people, whether it be parents or be leaders across our community, to, again, really prioritize and guide the decisions that are being made. We have another program called Zero Youth Violence, which follows the Cure Violence model, which looks at violence as a contagious disease. This is an international model. It's called Cure Violence, and it looks at every incident of violence is built on a prior incidence of violence, and that there are ways to stop it through changing community norms, through preventing retaliation. That's why we have relationships with gang members, because we want to let them know that they don't have to retaliate, and through meeting the needs of the highest risk individuals for committing violence. This program has been proven to work all across the world. We visited a site in Puerto Rico, and the agency did not pay for this. This was on our own dime. So before people start getting upset, you know, we've done ride-alongs in Philadelphia. This program has decreased violence up to 80% in the areas in the target neighborhood. So our target neighborhood right now is Old Fairgrounds, Jordan Heights area. And we're pouring a lot of resources. And what we do is we train people from the neighborhood to be credible messengers. So you said I have credibility in the streets with folks. That's the model. The model is that we get people from the area that know the struggles that people are going through to be the ones to create the intervention. So if I show up at a hospital bed and a young man's just been shot, and I tell him, you know, take a couple days and think it over. We talk to the little brothers, the cousins, the other gang members and say, you know, don't do it. You know, let's touch base. You know, what are the alternatives? They're more likely to listen to us because we're from the neighborhood and we have relationships with people in the community.
You said earlier in this conversation that you negotiated with gang leaders.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even, what do you have? I can't even fathom that. What do you have that gives you the ability to, what leverage do you have? I mean, what do you have that gives you the ability to be an equal, if you will, of a gang leader and talk him or her out of doing something that the gang fully intends to do and is even part of the culture of that gang?
I think what I have is respect and compassion and non-judgment. I can sit with you and I can sit together as you being the head of one of the largest nonprofit organizations in this community, or I can sit with the president of one of the local universities, or I can sit with the superintendent, or I can sit with the head of one of the healthcare networks, the local foundations, and I can also sit with a gang member because I understand at a human level, again, this the need to belong, the need for respect, and the need for, I'm not there to judge them. I'm there. The thing that's interesting that people don't realize and the narrative rejects, or we're told a different narrative, if the gang members want the community to be safe also. They want the community to be better. Gang members don't want, you take an older gang member, someone that's older being 30, 35, he doesn't want his little brother or his son to be murdered in the streets. You know, he doesn't want his mom to have a problem getting to work. And that's what we're offering. We're saying, and he doesn't want to stay in that gang. I mean, this is not something that people necessarily want to do. They just don't see the options. They don't see the alternatives. So we're negotiating with some of the largest business owners in the community around providing jobs for guys to get out of gangs. You know, one thing we always talk about is you can't take someone's gun from them, or you can't take someone's gang membership from them if you're not going to replace it with something else. So those are the conversations we're having. Like the young man that we met with today, I wasn't able to offer him a living wage of a $15 an hour job, but we were able to say to him, you know, you've been out of prison 2 days and we're going to connect you with a program that'll pay you $10 an hour. So you have his attention. You know, yeah. We're going to work with the unions to try to get you some type of skill, you know, because these guys bring leadership skills. I mean, it's just financially beneficial and cost effective to our community to, you know, a lot of employers are looking for guys that are on probation and parole. As insane as it sounds, that's what they want because they know they're going to show up. There's that extra level of incentive, you know, for people to show up. So it's when I sit down with them, they know my reputation. They know I keep my word. They know that I'm not there to judge them. They know that I've been there before. And they know that it represents, again, hope and options for, if not them, for their little brothers, for their cousins, for their sisters, you know. People can say, yeah, this is Dr. Batts, but I wasn't always Dr. Batts. And it took work, and it's not work that they can't do. Some of these guys are brilliant. Some of the most brilliant people I've met in my life were people that were incarcerated, but they just haven't had the same opportunities and people to believe in them.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm Alan Jennings, and I'm spellbound. I've hosted this show for a long time, and I'm just amazed at this conversation. Hassan Batts runs Promise Neighborhoods of Lehigh Valley. It's in the very key spot and the gang battles that are taking place in Allentown. And we're going to take a break, and I hope you'll stick around and listen to the final segment. Stay with us.
The many choices and real voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit wdiy.org. Thank you.
I'm Alan Jennings. I'm your host for Lehigh Valley Discourse this evening. This is WDIY. I have with me in the studio Hassan Batts, PhD, who runs Promise Neighborhoods of Lehigh Valley. And really a key person in Allentown's current challenges. And I'm amazed by Hassan. Hassan, you know, I've said for a long time that if society turns its back on its children, you shouldn't be surprised when 20 years later the children turn their backs on society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have been disinvesting in kids for far too long. The public school system is fundamentally unjust. I mean, it is the way we fund and govern public schools, in my judgment, is the single most effective way we lock inequity into our society. Land use planning rules that keep certain people out of those neighborhoods out in the suburbs, you know, not being there with healthcare when you need. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And we shouldn't be so surprised when we turn on people in need and then find that they are not making a go of it. So that's really what Hassan is saying. It's what I've been saying for a long time. And I'm glad, Hassan, to have you in the mix here, because I really consider you to be so critical to this conversation. So what is your prescription? I mean, let's say, as you know, we're working on a new neighborhood partnership program. And, you know, we expect to hopefully have $500,000 a year. And my guess is that we're going to, you know, the current one is expiring. We're going to apply for a new one. Hopefully we'll be successful at that. If we gave you the $500,000 or so a year, what would you do with the $500,000?
I just want to add to what you were saying. There's an African proverb that says, the child that is abandoned by the community will burn it down to feel its warmth. Abandoned by the village will burn it down to feel its warmth. So I think that speaks to what you're saying.
Far more articulate than my way of putting it, but spot on.
Yeah, that's what happens, right? Children need to be nurtured. They need connectivity. If you gave me $500,000, I would let you know on the front end that these are complex issues that have taken decades and generations to be created. So don't think that with that $500,000 we're going to change things overnight, that this is incremental work. And I would invest it in what I think is the key element to healing our community, and that's radical welcome and relationships. I would create spaces. I would create opportunities for people to come to know one another. And people don't realize that that's really the secret sauce that we use at Promise Neighborhoods. We're able to get 1,200 people out for book bag drives. We're able to get hundreds of people to come out for a peace walk, and it's really through relationship building.
Dozens of people for a planning session on new neighborhoods.
Diverse people. You were there, right?
It was great.
Dozens of people that they say don't exist, that they say don't care about Allentown.
You go, man.
But what we've learned is, and again, I go back to the shoulders of the giants that we stand on, because this work is not work that we do. This is work that I do. This is work that we do. This work is, you've been doing it for 30 years. You know, so weekly I'm looking at the Water Fountain Report. I'm putting it in grants. We're looking at the data. Just this morning, we were looking at some data. All the work we do is data-driven. People don't see that. They see us making videos. They see me standing out there.
Data drives the movement.
Data drives the movement. You know, this morning, we were just looking at the Upside Allentown survey. We were comparing it to the PNLV survey. We're sitting with folks from Allentown 2030. You know, so we do this. We use a collective impact approach, which is this cross-sector collaboration. I'm sitting there with folks from LVHN. I'm sitting there with folks from the city of Allentown. You know, we have community organizations in the building. We have neighbors there. And we're looking at the data. And what we're finding is and you know this already, that everyone, whether they're on the West End, whether they're in a higher bracket, whether they're in Center City, whether they're financially struggling, everyone wants safety. Everyone wants better housing. Everyone wants, you know, across the city. You know, what are the issues? The issues, we know what they are. You know, they're jobs. People need jobs. People need access to high-paying jobs. People need opportunities. We need to be a community where people that want to do better can do better. And people need to come to know one another. So I'm taking that $500,000. We're creating physical spaces, neighborhood level spaces where kids can be, and they can be around people that care about them, where they can be welcome, where they can draw, where they can play instruments, where they can do physical activities. You know, they can have a CrossFit class or something like that. Not huge edifices, but small neighborhood spaces where we can just have a park, pocket parks. Where people can come to know one another, and we'll have structured programming. We'll do book clubs and things like that. We'll watch movies and have discussions after the movies. We'll have lunch and learns. I mean, these are the things that we've been doing, and we've been able, you know, we just reinstituted with Julie Thomas's the Inside Allentown program. Like, people are knocking down the doors to get into that program, and it's because that it's been designed in such a way that it creates welcome. And you know, again, none of these ideas are new. I can't tell you that I've created any of this. You know, leadership programs have been going on for years, but what we do is we create leadership programs that are led by the people in the community. So with that $500,000, I'm going to hire people from the neighborhood. I'm going to hire folks in the neighborhood, and I'm going to give them hope, and I'm going to utilize their skills, and we're going to develop them to be the leaders across their community. And we're going to ask them and implement, you know, the solutions that they found. What we find is the people that are closest to the pain, that have the most intimate solutions, are often most ignored and told that they don't show up, or we're not realizing we're setting a table and not and inviting people to dinner and not asking them what their allergies are, what their preferences are. So when they don't show, we blame them rather than the structural issues that exist.
You know, there are so many different people have such different perspectives on, you know, how problems develop, how we fix them, and I'm a progressive. My politics are on the left side of the equation, and I'm sure yours are too. But there are some people who share our views, but who seem to think that this is all society's fault. That they're not to blame. They're not making any mistakes. That this is all society's fault. Where are you on that? Because you talked about the mistakes you made. You were very candid in saying, look, I screwed up. To what extent do you think the people who are in the spot they're in have nobody to blame but themselves? Do you know what I mean?
I believe in individual accountability. I believe that I am responsible for decisions that I made. However, it's not a either or, there's a both, and I also believe in a community accountability. So I think the community has contributed, that people are products of their environment. I think when we're talking about violence, that we've created a culture of violence across our community, from the language to, we're expelling kids in kindergarten. Like, that's rejection. You know, abandonment is violence. Rejection is violence. Like, you know, we're expelling kids in pre-K, excuse me. We're expelling kids in pre-K, pushing them out, telling them that they're less than, telling them that they're disposable. And what do disposable people do? Violence requires a certain ecosystem to grow. And part of it is, again, that rejection and that lack of belonging. And violence is a contagious disease, so it requires violence, you know. And we have to stop just looking at interpersonal violence. I mean, we have to look at the structural violence that exists. And we have to look at the country and the times that we live in. I mean, we have mass shooters that...
Almost daily,
right? So what does that tell the 14-year-old? Mm-hmm. You know, we have abuses by these institutions, whether it be teachers, whether it be police departments, whether it be of judges, whether it be these corporate folks. Like, there are abuses that are occurring across this community where people are doing a poor job of controlling themselves, and we expect a 14-year-old from 7th Street to have more discipline than a Wall Street broker. You know, yeah. So we have to create a culture of, again, compassion. It sounds hokey, but it's real. We have to create a culture of belonging, and we have to have a community where people can make mistakes, they can be honest about those mistakes, they can be held to account for those mistakes, and they can rejoin the tribe. You know, I stand here before you because, again, I was allowed second chances, I was allowed third chances, I was allowed fourth chances, I was allowed fifth chances, and there were people that loved me from within my family and from within a community that nurtured me, that said, you know, you are welcome to be a part of the solution.
Yeah, in my view, it's disastrous when people don't participate. I've long said that our society is far more threatened when poverty and despair lead to apathy and dependence than when it leads to anger and activism.
That's right.
That we should want people to be angry about their circumstances, that they're motivated to deal with it and to fight back and so on. Because, I mean, don't you agree that when I saw one of the mayoral elections, 4 voters showed up from in the Central Elementary School precinct for the mayoral election. 4 voters. And we wonder why nobody's paying attention to the neighborhoods. Your organization is fundamentally about that participation. It sometimes feels like you're saying, yeah, Jennings, shut up. But the role that I can play is that bridge between people with resources and people without, people with a voice and people with none. I hope that there's room for all of us in that equation.
You bring up a great point, Alan. So when we talk about the leadership changing and the table, the faces around the table changing, we're not saying that it's going to stay small or it's going to shrink and that you'll get kicked out the building. We're saying it's going to expand. We're saying there's a voice for Abuela. There's a voice for the grandmother from 2nd Street to contribute to the conversation. And that doesn't mean you don't add value to it. As you shared, your role is to be a bridge builder. Even for myself, I mean, I have privilege now. You know, I can I'm not living in poverty.
Charlie Marcon.
Yeah, right. I can go to the Hamilton and have lunch with whoever I want
in this
city, and they pay. So I share that to share that I have to be honest about that. Our job is we're bridge builders and we're gatekeepers, and we have to keep that gate open, and we have to bring the voices of the people that that are really going to be impacted to lead, and we have to learn when to listen and when to sit down. You know, when we're talking about issues centered around women's health, it's not my space to determine, you know, what decisions need to be made. And I think we have to carry that same energy into when we're talking about issues around a predominantly Hispanic community, that I have to sit back and I have to let, you know, people of Latinx descent lead. I have to listen to what does the community want, and how do we implement it? And our job is just to be bridge builders and to make sure the resources are available for that.
I want to get into an element of this whole thing. And, you kind of startled me, surprised me a little bit early on when you talked about girls, women being in the gang and beating the hell out of other women. Let's talk about women for a minute. I mean, we're two guys here. We don't know, you know, a whole lot. We're both married, I think. And, you know, frankly, a lot of my friends and probably myself are alive today because of the women in our lives who kept us from doing really stupid things. You know, I would argue that 70%+ of poverty is a result of girls or women making bad decisions about men in their lives. That fundamentally blames men for a lot of the problem. I get that. But I also think that women are an incredibly important part of the solution. What's your perspective on gender as it relates to the issues we've been discussing?
Well, again, we go back to the data, and we know that women make 71 cent for every dollar that a man makes. So I think that plays a huge role in when we're talking about poverty, that women are pushed into poverty, that the inequities exist. Then we also know the impact of domestic violence. You know, when we want to talk about violence, we can't ignore domestic violence. And this is not to say women are the victims, but women are often the survivors of domestic violence because we live in a patriarchal society. We live in a male chauvinistic society. And the impact is huge.
And I think, especially in the streets, don't you think so? I mean, in the neighborhoods, the machismo is a whole lot more alive than it is out in suburbs, don't you think?
I think it's more prevalent in terms of the spotlight is on it. But, I'm in these boardrooms, you know, so I think if you go out to the suburb, you see same levels of alcoholism and abuse. They're not being reported. Yeah. You know, when you have these intimate conversations with people, you know that it existed. You see the same levels of opioid use in the suburbs. You see the same levels of domestic violence in the suburbs. I think when you have concentrated poverty, you just per square foot, you have more people, so things are amplified, and then you have that poverty that exists. That's been my experience.
There was an individual, one of the gang members, who I think was one of the guys that died in the fighting, who was mentioned in the Morning Call article, I think on Sunday, who was 25 years old and said he had 7 kids. You can certainly blame that young man for those, you know, that, I mean, for he should certainly have responsibility. But you also have to wonder about the mom and the decisions she's made that contribute to that problem. And so it seems to me that women are really a key part of the solution. And, I mean, I think, for example, we long ago needed a woman in the White House, and it goes from there all the way down. Are you working with the girls as well as the boys?
So I just want to touch on, you're talking about Jonathan Williams. He was the first murder of 2019, and he had 7 children. And he was a phenomenal young man. All Jonathan wanted was a boxing gym. And I just bring that up because he's a perfect example. He wasn't a gang member. His work was centered around working with people with disabilities. He was a father to all of his children, even was a father to a stepchild that wasn't his. He worked hard. His mother, Jennifer Cox, who works with us now, loved her son. Jonathan was not this lost soul. You know, he was murdered over an argument that, well, we're not sure why he was murdered. His murder has not been solved. But this was a young man that was ingrained in the community, that has spoke before city council before. That was a great, great young man. Yes, he was 25 with seven children who he had relationships with, and his mother and his family, and, you know, still has relationships with. He took care of his little brother. He adored his sister who was going right to the military. I mean, this was a friend of mine, man. It's a dear guy. And we want to talk about the structural issue. So we had a cookout one day to connect the old head, so to speak, with some of the younger guys. Three guys were at the cookout. Three young guys, three older guys. So there were six of us there. And of those three, two of the young guys were arrested with guns, and Jonathan was murdered, you know? And these were the guys of promise in the community that we knew we could build relationships with. So the two have since come home, and we're working with them again. But Jonathan was murdered, man, and that was a huge loss for our community. And all he wanted was a boxing gym to you know, he was a trainer. He was a phenomenal trainer. In terms of us working with the women, yeah, we do have a gender-specific programming that we do in terms of developing leadership. We also partner with a group called Women Transforming the Valley that is out of this world, man. You know, shout out to Michelle and Evelyn that founded Women Transforming the Valley. They've actually been partnering with the United Way recently to do some work. And we've been doing some stuff with leadership with Roseanne Barker. You know, she just did 10 sessions mm-hmm. with some women in our community. You're nodding your head. Yeah, she does great work. She's been doing some work. So I do believe that our communities and both of our communities, right, have stood on the shoulders of women for a long time. Like I always talk about my mother not giving up on me. You know, our mothers are often our first teachers. They're often, you know, our first everything. The people that nurture us are first doctors and nurses. So I do think that there's a role that's critical.
Hassan Bhatt, hero. You are a remarkable guy. I'm proud to be able to work with you and call you an ally. And I hope that you have every bit of success that you can possibly imagine. This community needs guys like you, people like you, to do the work that we need to have done. And I want to thank you, not just for being on this show, but for the good work you do. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. Hopefully you've learned a lot from listening to Dr. Hassan Bhatt from Promise Neighborhoods of the Lehigh Valley.